Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you for being back in this room. We're running a little bit late, but I think we can make up that time during the lunch break, so we'll still have half an hour. Now to hear from Professor Naya Fulvey-Roth, who is Professor of Epidemiology and Director of the Copenhagen Health Complexity Center at the University of Copenhagen. Her expertise spans various domains, including sleep, health inequality, young adult health, and early life adversity, with a focus on health complexity, causal inference, and life course mechanisms. She's particularly interested in complex systems theory and how it intersects with methodological insights from causal inference theory, and she is a principal investigator of the DenLife study, which looks at different levels of exposome data covering the totality of measured lifetime exposures in 2 million people in Denmark. So without further ado.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Maria, for organizing this. This is amazing to be in this room with so many, you know, clever people. So looking forward for, you know, presenting, but also the discussion at the end of this session, I think. Yeah, anyway. So now, this morning, we heard, especially from David, we heard more about really child health and what's going on in terms of the social determinants of child health. And Emily talked also about, you know, family support policies, specifically on parental leave reforms. And now we transition a little bit into the young adulthood. And this is what I will be talking, showing you some of the work that we've been doing specifically on the transition period into young adulthood. And I'll get back to what young adulthood is in a second. I will also focus a lot on what are the early drivers of health in young adulthood. And by the end of the talk, and since I am also really interested in complex adaptive systems, I will just give a little bit on, you know, how insight into other ways of working with mental health in this specific age group that really builds on complex system thinking. So, what is young adulthood? And an interesting thing is that when you grow older, you tend to expand the time where you think it's young adulthood. Anyway, I'm definitely well beyond young adulthood, but I can see other people in here who is in that age group. So there are different definitions on young adulthood, but what I will be talking about today is people between 16, 18, and then up till around 30. So that's that period, that time span. And why am I especially interested in this period? It's because I think it's an extremely important period, and I also call it a transitional period. It's a period where you establish yourself in adult life. This is the period where most people move from their family home and into independent living or living with friends, or it's the time period where most people start their education, finish their education, and transition into labor market and work. It's also the period where most people start forming more long-term partnerships, and a lot of people also form families. So one thing is that it's an important period for people themselves in terms of their long-term mental and social, physical well-being. But it's also a period where you create the foundation for the next generation. So that's why I think this period is so interesting. At the same time, it's also a period of time where we have almost no contact with people from the healthcare system. So we don't know a lot about young adults, apart maybe from mental health, and we can get back to that. For me, it's important, and I will talk about mental health, but it's important to think about mental health as something that is closely connected to our physical health, our cognitive and social development as well. So this is the point here, saying you need to think about these things as connected. You also, and this is some of the things that we've tried to do, think about mental health as something that is being driven by things that happen throughout the entire life course over time from people born, but also across multiple dimensions or multiple scales. Things happening at the molecular, individual, group, and population level. And these things are not, I don't think we can isolate the effect of each of them. And this is a little bit of the complexity thinking, but these things dynamically affect each other in feedback mechanisms and by adaptive behaviors over the life course. And we're trying to incorporate some of that thinking into our understanding on what drives health in young adults. There's a lot of, and you can see all kinds of versions of this, that public health is challenged. One thing that we do consistently see across many countries is that you have an increasing, and David showed that very nice, health inequalities rising, poor mental health rising, sleep issues, that's an interest of mine, so I've added it in there as well. But sleep issues are also rising due to, of course, combined with the other two, but also due to climate things. And, you know, so there's heat, for example. A good example today is, you know, people sleep much more poorly when there's a lot of heat. This is increasing. It's increasing, maybe apart from health inequality, but sleep and mental health problems are increasing more in young adults than in other age groups. So that also makes it particularly interesting to look at. This is this is data from the Lancet Psychiatry Commission on Youth Mental Health. And essentially here it's showing the proportion of young people across a number of different countries and the change over time in mental health problems in this age group. And you don't need to see the details, but really see the pattern here. So across multiple sites, using multiple different measures of mental health, across both men and women, you see an increase in mental health problems in this particular age group. It's also important to say, and this is from the same commission, but say that mental health is manifest in multiple ways. So it comes in, you know, in the small symptoms of starting poor sleep, low mood kind of things, and then all the way to actual clinical psychiatric diagnosis that also have manifest in many different ways. So this is by itself not one thing. But it is, you know, it's a combination, it's what I would call a network of many different symptoms. And that's just, I think, important to keep in mind. I will now, if you think about it, I will move back and think about what are the early life drivers of mental health problems, not only mental health problems, but what are health problems in young adulthood. And I have a real interest in what we call childhood adversity. David already introduced a little bit to this. When I talk about childhood adversity, I talk about the things that create stress in the families, including the socioeconomic conditions, so poverty and long-term unemployment and stuff like that. So I don't see a distinction between these. And I apologize, there's a little bit of Danish in here, but I realize I don't understand French, so there are a lot of things I don't understand, so now you can get the feeling of what that means. But anyway, I really like the picture because I think it illustrates what's going on, that some children grow up not only in poverty, but these children also, David also showed that, they show up with parents who have mental health problems. They show up with, you know, there are a lot of somatic conditions in those families as well. So it's a clustering. It's a clustering and accumulation of disadvantage, and they are likely to affect health and well-being across the entire life course. When we study this, There is one major challenge, and that is that if you really want to look at social disadvantage, if you really want to understand mental health, then it's problematic to do it in a traditional survey approach. And why is that? It's because those who participate in surveys are not those who are most disadvantaged or have the most mental health problems. So there's a clear selection into the way we generate data, which is for some problems not so problematic. For mental health and clear social disadvantage, I think it's a major problem. So this is a real epidemiology comment, but I think it does have implications because we might not really get the full understanding on what's going on. This is one of the reasons why we've created the Danish Life Course Cohort Study. It's a cohort study that is fully based on nationwide administrative registers. So that means it includes everyone. It includes everyone born in Denmark since 1980. Denmark is a much smaller country than France, so that is 2.2 million people that's been born in Denmark since we're actually expanding it now, so we might get up to 3 million. It's approximately, 2 to 3 million people. The beauty of that is that we have everyone. And we have now, it's taken us years and years, and we keep building on this. We now connected data from, I just talked to my data manager, 65 different administrative registers. On social condition, on health conditions, on prescriptions, on hospitalizations, we have social cognitive data in there, we have school grades, we have conscription, so IQ measures, and all kinds of, all of the things you can get. And I've been working with people in France also on using nationwide registers from France as part of the European health data space. And I know that we have a completely different way in Denmark because of the history of using administrative registers for research. We have a very high trust in the population that allows us to do things like this. So it really goes down to the trust of the population. This is also why when I work with these data, I feel really humble. And I really think about how we, and of course, all of this happens within a secured environment at Denmark Statistics. We are expanding it now because I think that's also really important with, you saw this multi-scale, so we're expanding it now with information about neighborhoods, but also information about environment, so air pollution, but also green space and noise and all of that. The idea is to create a data set that captures what you could call the environmental and social expert zone. All of that is what we've been building on in terms of understanding these life courses. The other good thing about this is because it's administrative data, people stay, right? So we don't have the problem with what is often called more technical attrition. So we have everyone over their entire life course. And the oldest are now in their 40s. We were specifically interested in this about, what is childhood adversity. And we've used a lot of our time in really thinking about how could we, based on administrative data, which is, and that is also fair to say when I've now said all the positive things about, administrative data, it's also in many ways crude data because it's not collected for research, right? So you need to really think carefully about what kind of indicators can you use from that administrative registers to really fit with the theories you have about the things you want to investigate. So we used a lot of time, and I think this is where theory really becomes important. So we need to think carefully about, not just put everything in there, but carefully about what is it we want to measure and how can we do that with the available data. We ended up, and this was a longer process where we had people who were expert in psychiatry and child health and family medicine, in epidemiology and so on. We were a group of people really reading theory, saying what are the dimensions that we would be interested in a childhood if we focus on the social dimensions. One thing is, and I think David said that very nicely, this is the whole thing about material deprivation. It's poverty, it's long-term unemployment, it's lack of resources, essentially. So that is one, and we use that. We have indicators of family poverty and long-term unemployment that we could find in the registers. The second one is a very different dimension, which has to do with the fact that if you lose someone that is supposed to take care of you, or so your parents, or you lose a sibling, that is affecting the family, the family dynamics. And one thing is that you lose them, that they die, but the threat of loss is also equally, maybe not equal, I think you can discuss that, but that is highly stressful as well. So living with a parent who has a life-threatening cancer diagnosis, for example, is affecting the family environment. So that is the second dimension. The last dimension is really, and this, to be honest, this was the hardest to capture in administrative data, is what happens in the family. What is the family dynamics? And we tried to do that, and that is, of course, not perfect. But we tried to do that with multiple indicators. One of them, of course, being that if someone has decided that this child cannot live at home, so being placed in foster care, being placed out of the home environment. So there's been a decision that is a good indicator that something wrong in the family environment. But we also know that children who grow up in families with severe psychiatric illness, either with siblings or parents, is affecting the family dynamics. And the same goes with alcohol and drug abuse. And of course, if there's a divorce or maternal separation going on. So all of these were different indicators. So what we try to do is have indicators for what is the underlying concept. And then I won't bore you with, you know, a lot of the statistics, but we did use all of the data from children were born until they were 16. And we modeled, used all of the 2 million children, model what are patterns of adversity. And quite interesting, we actually came up with 5 quite consistent groups. And that's these 5 groups. And we've done all kind of, you know, validation back and forth and over temporal and other and so on. And the interesting thing is now I just saw, I knew about David's thing, but I can, you know, it's actually some of this replicates across countries as well. And we have these 5 groups. One, and luckily the biggest group, is the low adversity group, is children who may experience 1 of 2 things, adversities during childhood, but most people can actually handle that. That's the biggest group. We have one group that are consistently early life material deprivation, poverty, long-term parental unemployment in the preschool period. These, I'm not so concerned about these. These are children growing up in families where the parents are young parents, you know, transitioning into labor market, may have periods of, you know, unstable employment. We see that they don't have a lot of, you know, major health issues. And again, you have to remember when I say all of this, this is in a Danish context where we are really, you know, proud about our free and equal access to care. We are also really proud about our social security system. So a lot of this may look worse in other settings. We have one. I just hope it's not my phone. No, it was my phone. Okay. Anyway, persistent material deprivation is a group of about 20% in Denmark that have, you know, have on in and out of poverty, in and out of long-term unemployment for the parents, of course. As a different group, we really have these somatic conditions in the family, so that's not necessarily a socioeconomically disadvantaged group, but they have high, you know, stress levels. And then the last group, which is the high adversity group, it's 3% approximately. It's not high percentage, but it's a lot of children, right? And they have just high exposure across all of the three dimensions, and they tend to accumulate over time. So it becomes worse and worse when the children grow older. Just keep these four groups in mind, because this is what I will be talking about now. Because what happens to them when they enter, you know, young adulthood? And I will get back to mental health, I promise you. But what happens here, and just to start out, I'm a public health researcher, so really start out with the public health perspective, and the ultimate public health outcome is death. So we started looking at, you know, mortality before people turn 35. This should, in a setting like Denmark, be fully preventable, right? No one should die before they're 35. And here you have the same five groups as I showed you before. The green one on the bottom is the high adversity, no, the low adversity one, I'm sorry. And the red one at the top is the high adversity. We see that those in the high adversity, and then of course the ones in between are the other groups. But just looking at the most extreme, we see a 4 times higher risk of dying before they turn 35. To be honest, I was quite surprised that we would find something like this in the Danish, and if you saw David's views, we are really at the top of everything in terms of, you know, child well-being and stuff like that. And even in that context, we find these strong effects. So I think there's something we really need to address. We've also looked just another study on the lifelong, I put Bettina up here, she's really, you know, done a lot of this work. We looked, so it's not only, and this is again to say that things are not focused only on one element, but it goes across multiple dimensions. So we have to think across, you know, out of the box and not only think about, you know, health as something. Here we look at, are these groups being affected across multiple dimensions in their young adult life? And yes, here we look at the yellow one being high users of healthcare, the second one being high users of social welfare benefits, so being on long-term social welfare benefits before they turn 30, and the last one being having a criminal conviction. And of course, in the low adversity group, there are people who around, you know, 5 to 14% who are in contact with some of these welfare systems before they turn 30. But if you go to the other end of this graph, you see that the prevalence is just so much higher in the high adversity group. It's almost half of these children who, when they turn into go into young adulthood, have been high users, have been on long-term welfare benefits, have a criminal conviction, and about a fifth of them are high users of healthcare services at this point. So it really translates across dimensions. And I also just wanted to show you this, that this is something that is not definitely not just happening when they go into to young adulthood. We can see the pattern already from when they're born. And this is simply how many hospitalizations each of these groups have. And the lowest one is, again, the green is the low adversity, the red one is the high adversity. And what you can see is that the high adversity is high on hospitalization from the day they're born until, you know, this is until 24. What you cannot see from this graph is, and this is a really generalized, you know, interpretation, but what we generally see is that in the first 2 or 3 years, these children come to the hospital with infections. Respiratory infections, ear infections, all kinds of infections. which affects their language development, for example, making them less, more vulnerable to just entering, you know, the school. Then in the school years, they come to the hospital with accidents. So things that happens, accidents that happens in the home environment. And then when we turn into teenage years, it starts, the mental health condition starts turning in. So this is a pattern that goes across multiple dimensions and things. And this is across all of the ICD codes. You shouldn't see the details of that, but see the pattern, the red ones on top on all, you know, essentially all of them, maybe apart cancer, but we can talk about that. So what is then driving this? And we've done a lot of that, and I won't have time to go into all of these details, but I'll just show you this one. This is really descriptive data, but it comes from a paper where we try to do a mediation analysis and see how much of the effect of childhood adversity on the fact that they end up in long-term social benefits is actually mediated or explained by mental health conditions. We found that a lot of it is explained by the fact that children with high adversity, they have a lot more mental health problems, but also that these children are more vulnerable to the mental health problems they have, so they have stronger consequences in terms of social welfare benefits. Okay, so these are kind of the key findings that I wanted to show you, that there's drivers, early life drivers, that really affects mental health, but mental health as being part of a broader landscape of things that happens to young adults in this transition period. I will just briefly end up with a little bit of system thinking into this, because this is something I'm really interested in, is really how these dynamics unfold across different dimensions. So again, really looking into, instead of trying to tease out this, really engaging with the fact that things are connected, things affect each other, and things change over time. And we've done, and this is maybe only for the ones who are really interested in this, but there are other ways of trying to map out these ways of interacting networks over time. And we've done a couple of papers on how do you map these more complex problems using other tools than the ones that we are normally using in epidemiology. And one of the ways is really to start to think about dimensions and time in a much more connected way than I think we've been doing before. And I will just end by showing you some work we've done on what we call the young adult sleep model and evolving causal loop diagram on mental health dynamics. It's awful to show these models on a slide like this, because the whole point of them is that they are dynamic models. So you want to see the dynamics of the, so that is why, you know, you should go and you should scan that one and try it yourself. So there's an interactive interface where you can try it out yourself. And you can then start looking at, so the colors here really identifies the different domains. This is a biopsychosocial model. For each of the links in there, if you go into the interactive part of it, you can find literature references to every single link on this. And you can use these models to start, you know, zooming in on specific dynamics in the system, like the one here on depression and sleep and smoking. You can also use it to, instead of look at the specific factors, then think about mental health as something that, or health in general, as something that emerges from the connections of all of these things. And the things that are most connected And this is a different way, and I know Lisa will be talking about social networks also later, but this is a different way of thinking about networks. So those that are the central nodes in the network, what are the things that are most involved in most of these feedback mechanisms? Maybe that can give us some indications of where we can start doing interventions. We can also use it, so this one is really focusing on what is reinforcing, what is creating emergent phenomena, such as mental health crisis. But we can also use it to start thinking about across scale, what are things we can do to balance these out. So we, from our biological system, we know the idea of balancing systems. We that's our homeostasis, essentially. If you think about that in the similar way, if you have a system that creates emergent mental health problems, and I know it gets a little technical here, but then you can also start thinking about how can I start to balance the whole system? And then it gives you multiple entry points into the system to do those balancing approaches. And that can be across levels, again, from policies at the societal levels to individual treatment. But if you can think about how do I really try to balance the system, I will end by this, and I almost did it on time. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.